Parker laughed. I'll be glad to see you when you get back, Roosevelt. In the new year, Roosevelt's longing to be appointed assistant secretary was spurred by renewed press criticism of the deadlock at police headquarters. Most complaints were directed at Parker, but they also reflected unfavorably on the president of the board. Editors of all political persuasions agreed that the quarreling between commissioners was a discredit to the department, and a detriment to public welfare. It was enough, remarked the Herald, to make citizens nostalgic for the corrupt but super-efficient force of yesteryear. The simple fact is that this much-heralded reform board has proved a public disappointment and a failure. The Society for the Prevention of Crime, which had strongly supported Roosevelt in the past, condemned the commissioners for lack of executive vigor and indignity of demeanor, while the Reverend Charles H. Parkhurst, in a clear reference to Roosevelt's courtship of Boss Platt, scorned those who consent spaniel-like to lick the hand of their master. Afraid that some of this publicity would reach the ears of the president-elect, Roosevelt announced on 8 January, I shall hereafter refuse to take part in any wranglings or bickerings on this board. They are not only unseemly, but detrimental to the discipline of the force. Commissioner Parker affably agreed to do the same, and a measure of peace returned to Mulberry Street. Thomas Collier Platt was nominated for the Senate on 14 January 1897 by a Republican caucus vote of 147-7. His first reaction on hearing the news was to ask for a list of the 7 Choate supporters and put it in his pocket. This suggests that Roosevelt had been prudent, if nothing else, in deserting Choate the month before. Platt was duly elected on 20 January and immediately became a major, if inscrutable, factor in Roosevelt's campaign for office. The police commissioner, meanwhile, optimistically prepared himself for his future responsibilities, inviting Alfred Thayer Mahan back to Sagamore Hill, addressing the U.S. Naval Academy on 23 January, and working with concentrated speed on a revised version of his Naval War of 1812. The manuscript had been commissioned by Sir William Laird Close, naval correspondent of the London Times and editor of the official history of the British Navy, then in preparation. Roosevelt inserted a pretty strong plea for a powerful navy into his text. February came and went with no encouraging news. McKinley was preoccupied with cabinet appointments and pre-inaugural arrangements, and Platt remained silent. But Roosevelt continued to hope. I shall probably take it, he told Bammy, because I am intensely interested in our navy, and know a good deal about it, and it would mean 4 years' work. He did not see himself surviving a year in his present job, even if obliged to remain. His truce with cunning, unscrupulous, shifty Parker lasted less than 5 weeks, and by the end of February, he was complaining of almost intolerable difficulty at Mulberry Street. Commissioner Grant was now firmly allied with Parker, and Roosevelt paused in a moment of bitter humor to wonder how so great a general could have produced so lumpish a son. Grant is one of the most interesting studies that I know of, from the point of view of atavism. I am sure his brain must reproduce that of some long-lost arboreal ancestor. By 4 March, when William McKinley was inaugurated, the situation at police headquarters had become an open scandal. Newspapers that day carried reports of an almost total breakdown of discipline in the force, new outbreaks of corruption, tearful threats of resignation by Chief Conlon, and rabid partisan squabbles between Democratic and Republican officers, echoing those among the 4 commissioners, who seemed scarcely able to stand the sight of one another anymore. I am very sorry that I ever appointed Andrew D. Parker, Mayor Strong commented sadly. I am just as sorry that it is beyond my power to remove him from office. A reporter pointed out that he had, nevertheless, the power to find Parker guilty of the charges leveled against him last summer. Strong hesitated for 2 weeks, then at last, on 17 March, dismissed Parker for proven neglect of duty. But the sentence was subject to gubernatorial approval. So in the meantime, Parker smilingly stayed on. During the rest of March and on through the first 5 days of April, a cast of some 25 characters lobbied, fought, bartered, bullied, and pleaded for and against Roosevelt's appointment as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Lodge acted as coordinator of the pro-Roosevelt group, whose ranks included John Hay, Speaker Reed, Secretary of the Interior Cornelius Bliss, Judge William Howard Taft of Ohio, and even Vice President Hobart. Mrs. Storer haughtily withdrew when McKinley, who disliked being beholden to anybody, gave her husband the second-rate ambassadorship to Belgium. Mark Hanna was reported favorable to Roosevelt's nomination immediately after the inauguration, but was so plagued by other rivals for McKinley's favor that Lodge hesitated to approach him. The chairman had been seen slinging a pebble at a skunk in a Georgetown garden and growling, "By God, he looks like an office seeker." Lodge was at a loss to explain the delay in appointing his deserving young friend. "The only, absolutely the only thing I can hear adverse," he wrote, "is that there is a fear that you will want to fight somebody at once." This, indeed, was the essence of the problem. In all the welter of contradictory reports, rumors, and ambiguous memoirs surrounding the Navy Department negotiations, one rock constantly breaks the surface. McKinley's belief that once Roosevelt came to Washington, he would seek to involve the United States in war. The president wanted nothing so much as 4 years of peace and stability, so that the corporate interests he represented could continue their growth. He was by nature a small-town son of the Middle West, who shied away from large schemes and foreign entanglements. The French ambassador in Washington found him defensively aware of his own provincialism, ignorant of the wide world. But as a Civil War veteran, he had a genuine horror of bloodshed. On the eve of his inauguration, he had told Grover Cleveland that if he could avert the terrible calamity of war while in office, he would be the happiest man in the world. Mark Hanna felt the same. "The United States must not have any damn trouble with anybody." Roosevelt's response was to send sweet assurances via Lodge to the Secretary of the Navy that if appointed, he would faithfully execute administration policies. What was more, "I shall stay in Washington, hot weather or any other weather, whenever he wants me to stay there." No message could have been more shrewdly calculated to appeal to the Secretary, especially the heavy hint about looking after the department in summer. John D. Long, whom Roosevelt knew well from Civil Service Commission days, was a comfortable old Yankee, mildly hypochondriac, who liked nothing so much as to potter around his country home in Hingham Harbor, Massachusetts, and write little books of poetry with titles like At the Fireside and Bites of a Cherry. Long had been reported nervous about Roosevelt's appointment. "If he becomes Assistant Secretary of the Navy, he will dominate the department within 6 months." But now he told Lodge that he would be happy to have the young man aboard, and the pressure on McKinley redoubled. Senator Platt capitulated in early April when he was persuaded by his lieutenants that Roosevelt in Washington would be much less of a nuisance to the organization than Roosevelt in New York. The easy boss grudgingly told McKinley to go ahead with the appointment, as long as nobody thought that he had suggested it. "He hates Roosevelt like poison," remarked a presidential aide. And so, on 6 April 1897, Theodore Roosevelt was nominated as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, at a salary of $4,500 a year. Moved almost to tears by the loyalty of his friends, he telegraphed congratulations. "Honorable H. C. Lodge, 1765 Mass Avenue, Washington, D.C. Sinbad has evidently landed the old man of the sea." 2 days later, the Senate confirmed the appointment. Senator Platt was a noticeable absentee from the floor when the vote was called. Andrew D. Parker was greatly amused when news of Roosevelt's imminent departure circulated through headquarters. "What a glorious retreat," he exclaimed, and laughed for a long time. Contemptuous to the last, he stayed away from Roosevelt's last board meeting on Saturday, 17 April. So, too, did Grant, leaving only Avery Andrews to stare across the big table and express polite regrets on behalf of the police department. Since there was no quorum, a resolution thanking Roosevelt for his services could not be entered into the minutes. They waited until noon, and then, as headquarters began to close down for the half-holiday, Roosevelt declared the meeting adjourned. "I am sorry," he said wistfully. "There were matters of importance which I wished to bring up." He shook a few hands, then went into his office to pack up his papers. Chief Conlon did not come in to say goodbye. Later, when Roosevelt walked down the main corridor for the last time, a guard on duty outside Conlon's office threw the door open for him. "No," said Roosevelt with a gesture of disgust. "I am not going in there." The guard hesitated. "Well, goodbye, Mr. President." "Goodbye," Roosevelt responded, taking his hand. Then apparently, as an afterthought, I shall be sorry for you when I am gone. Although the world claimed, with possible truth, that New Yorkers were pleased to see Roosevelt go, few could deny that his record as commissioner was impressive. The service he has rendered to the city is second to that of none, commented the New York Times. And considering the conditions surrounding it, it is in our judgment unequaled. He had proved that it was possible to enforce an unpopular law, and by enforcing it, had taught the doctrine of respect for the law. He had given New York City its first honest election in living memory. In less than 2 years, Roosevelt had depoliticized and de-ethnicized the force, making it once more a neutral arm of government. He had broken its connections with the underworld, toughened the police trial system, and largely eliminated corruption in the ranks. The attrition rate of venal officers had tripled during his presidency of the board, while the hiring of new recruits had quadrupled. In spite of Roosevelt's decisions to raise physical admission standards above those of the U.S. Army, lower the maximum age requirement, and apply the rules of civil service reform to written examinations. As a result, the average New York patrolman was now bigger, younger, and smarter. He was also much more honest, since badges were no longer for sale, and more soldier-like, the military ideal having been a particular feature of the departing commissioner's philosophy. Between May 1895 and April 1897, Roosevelt had added 1,600 such men to the force. Those officers he managed to promote before the deadlock began in March 1896 were, with one or two exceptions, men of good quality. They had brought about such an improvement in discipline that even when morale sank to its low ebb a year later, the force was still operating with a fair degree of efficiency. Crime and vice rates were down. Order was being kept throughout the city, and police courtesy, a particular obsession of Roosevelt's, had noticeably improved. During the Reform Board's administration, he had personally brought about the closure of 100 of the worst tenement slums seen on his famous night patrols. Patrol wagon response was quicker. Many new station houses had been built, and other ones modernized. Marksmanship scores, thanks to the adoption of the standardized .32 Colt, were climbing. And the bicycle squad, first of its kind in the world, was being imitated all over the United States and in Europe. Unfortunately, Roosevelt's genius for moral warfare obscured his more practical achievements as commissioner, both during his tenure and for some time after he left Mulberry Street. An inescapable aura of defeat clouded his resignation. He was the first among his colleagues to quit, having served less than one-third of a 6-year term. No matter what he said about an honorable way out of this beastly job, the fact remained that he was leaving a position of supreme responsibility for a subservient one. Perhaps that is why Commissioner Parker found his retreat so funny. Others found it sad, particularly the stoop-sitters of Number 303, who missed him more and more as life on Mulberry Street returned slowly to normal. The next president of the police board, Frank Moss, was an ardent reformer who insisted on continuing Roosevelt's policies, but his teeth inspired no metaphors, and his ascent of the front steps of police headquarters lacked spectator interest. Board meetings were held twice weekly as usual, but with no boss leader of men to blow up at Parker's taunts, they were anticlimactic. As the Harper's Weekly man remarked, the Roosevelt commissionership was never in the least dull. It had been one long elegant shindy, from the day he took office to the day he resigned. Ironically, Parker's power began to wane in the months following Roosevelt's departure. His partnership with Frederick D. Grant broke up in June, when the latter resigned in order to rejoin the army, and was replaced by a commissioner who naturally sided with Moss and Andrews. On 12 July, Governor Frank S. Black denied Mayor Strong's attempt to oust Parker, saying that the evidence against him was patently trivial. But this proved a Pyrrhic victory, for the resignation of Chief Conlon on 24 July left Parker without an ally at headquarters. He was unable to prevent the promotion, at last, of Roosevelt's protégés, Brooks and McCullough, along with a large number of other worthy officers whose rise had been blocked beneath them. Inspector McCullough subsequently became chief, to Roosevelt's great delight. Mayor Strong did not run for re-election in November. As boss Richard Croker had predicted, the people grew weary of reform and voted for a return of the old democracy. By the end of the year, it was business as usual at Tammany Hall. What happened to Andrew D. Parker in the years that followed is not known. he vanishes from history as he entered it, a handsome, smiling enigma. The Stoop-Sitters were never able to agree as to the reason for his poisonous hostility to Theodore Roosevelt. Reese suggested pure spite. Steffens, the more abstract pleasure of a man who liked to sit back and pull wires just to see the puppets jump. Other theories were advanced, of greater and less complexity, but never, it seems, the most fundamental of all, that Parker simply hated Roosevelt and wished to do him ill. Those who loved Roosevelt were so many and so ardent that they found it hard to believe that a certain minority always detested him. Parker was of this ilk. He was also, as it happened, the only associate whom Roosevelt never managed to bend to his own will, and significantly, the only adversary from whom that happy warrior ever ran away. Chapter 22. The Hot Weather Secretary. With his own hand fearless, steered he the long serpent, strained the creaking cordage, bent each boom and gaff. Theodore Roosevelt's wellsprings of nostalgia for boyhood and youth tended always to surge and spill in moments of self-fulfillment. So as he prepared to take office as Assistant Secretary of the Navy on 19 April 1897, memories flooded back of his revered uncle James Bullock, builder of the Confederate warship Alabama, and of his mother, who used to talk to me as a little shaver about ships, 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 and fighting of ships till they sank into the depths of my soul. Allowing the stream of consciousness to flow unchecked, he recalled how, as a Harvard senior, he had dreamed of writing The Naval War of 1812. "When the professor thought I ought to be on mathematics and the languages, my mind was running to ships that were fighting each other." The past was still much in his thoughts when he searched for a suitable desk in the Navy Department storage room. He selected the massive piece of mahogany used by Assistant Secretary Gustavus Fox, another juvenile hero, during the Civil War. Especially pleasing, to Roosevelt's eye, were two beautifully carved monitors which bulged out of each side panel, trailing rudders and anchors, and a group of wooden cannons protecting the wooden stars and stripes about where his belly would be when he leaned forward to write. The desk was dusted and polished and carried up to his freshly painted office. When Roosevelt sat down behind it, he could swivel in his chair and gaze through the window at the White House lawns and gardens, a view equally as good as that enjoyed by the Secretary of the Navy himself. "Best man for the job," John D. Long wrote in his diary after his first formal meeting with Roosevelt. Whatever misgivings he may have had about him earlier soon changed to avuncular fondness. The young New Yorker was polite, charming, and seemed to be sincere in promising to be entirely loyal and subordinate. Long concluded that Roosevelt would be an ideal working partner, amply compensating for his own lack of naval expertise, yet unlikely, on the grounds of immaturity, to usurp full authority. Certainly the secretary was everything the assistant secretary was not. Small, soft, plump, and white-haired, Long looked and acted like a Dickensian grandfather, although he was in fact only 58. Nobody would want to hurt or bewilder such a perfect dear, to use Roosevelt's own affectionate phrase. The mild eyes beamed with kindness rather than intelligence, and they clouded quickly with boredom when naval conversation became too technical. Abstruse ordnance specifications and blueprints for dry dock construction were best left to specialists, in Long's opinion. He saw no reason to tax his brain unnecessarily. Fortunately, Roosevelt had a gargantuan appetite for such data and could safely be entrusted with them. Long was by nature indolent. His gestures were few and tranquil, and there was a slowness in his gait which regular visits to the corn doctor did little to improve. From time to time he would indulge in bursts of hard, efficient work, but always felt the need to rest up afterward. On the whole, he was content to watch the department function according to the principles of laissez-faire. Roosevelt had no objection to this policy. The less work Long wanted to do, the more power he could arrogate to himself. His own job was so loosely defined by Congress that it could expand to embrace any duties as may be prescribed by the Secretary of the Navy. All he had to do was win Long's confidence while unobtrusively relieving him of more and more responsibility. By summer, with luck, he would be so much in control that Long might amble off to Massachusetts for a full 2 months, leaving him to push through his own private plans as acting secretary. But no matter how calculating his strategy, There was nothing insincere about Roosevelt's frequently voiced praises of John D. Long. "My chief is one of the most high-minded, honorable, and upright gentlemen I have ever had the good fortune to serve under." The American press was largely optimistic about Long and Roosevelt as a team. "Nearly everybody in Washington is glad that Theodore Roosevelt has come back to the Capitol," reported the Chicago Times-Herald correspondent. "He is by long odds one of the most interesting of the younger men seen here in recent years." The Washington Post looked forward to lots of hot copy now the famous headliner was back in town. "Of course he will bring with him all that machinery of disturbance and upheaval which is as much a part of his entourage as the very air he breathes, but who knows that the Navy Department will not be the better for a little dislocation and readjustment." Overseas newspapers, such as the London Times, took rather less pleasure in the menacing prospect of Roosevelt influencing America's naval policy. With Cuba and Hawaii ripe for conquest and annexation, what now seems ominous is his extreme jingoism. Roosevelt knew that President McKinley and Chairman, now Senator, Hanna, shared this nervousness, and he was at pains to reassure them, as well as Long, that he intended to be a quiet, obedient servant of the administration. "I am sedate now," he laughingly told the Tribune reporter. All the same, he could not resist inserting four separate warnings of possible trouble with Cuba into a memorandum on fleet preparedness requested by President McKinley on 26 April. The document, which was written and delivered that same day, could not otherwise be faulted for its effortless sorting out of disparate facts of marine dynamics, repair and maintenance schedules, geography, and current affairs. Roosevelt had been at his desk for just 1 week. "He is one hell of a secretary," Congressman W.I. Guffin remarked to Senator Shelby Cullom, unconsciously dropping the qualifier in Roosevelt's title. Sedate as his official image may have been in the early spring of 1897, his private activities more than justified foreign dread of his appointment. Quickly, efficiently, and unobtrusively, he established himself as the administration's most ardent expansionist. A new spirit of intrigue affected his behavior, quite at odds with his usual policy of operating in the full glare of public opinion. Never more than a casual clubman, he began to lunch and dine almost daily at the Metropolitan Club, assembling within its exclusive confines a coterie much more influential than the old Hay Adams circle, now broken up. It consisted of senators and representatives, Navy and Army officers, writers, socialites, lawyers, and scientists, men linked as much by Roosevelt's motley personality as by their common political belief, namely, that manifest destiny called for the United States to free Cuba, annex Hawaii, and raise the American flag supreme over the Western Hemisphere. This expansionist lobby was not entirely Roosevelt's creation. Its original members had begun to work together in the last months of the Harrison administration, as America's last frontier fell and Hawaii simultaneously floated into the national consciousness. But their organization had remained loose and their foreign policy uncoordinated all through the Cleveland administration, partly due to the president's own ambivalent attitudes to Hawaii on the one hand and Venezuela on the other. Not until William McKinley took office, amid reports of Japanese ambitions in the Pacific and increased Spanish repression in the Caribbean, did the expansionists begin to close ranks and cast about for a natural leader. Whether they chose to follow Roosevelt or Roosevelt chose to lead them is a Tolstoyan question of no great consequence, given the group's unanimity of purpose. Examples of how he used Captain Alfred Thayer Mahan and Commodore George Dewey to advance his own interest, while also advancing their own, merit separate consideration. Other members of the lobby included Senators Henry Cabot Lodge, William E. Chandler, W.P. Fry, and Don Cameron, all powers on the Hill. Commander Charles H. Davis, Chief of Naval Intelligence, the philosopher Brooks Adams, shyer, more intense, and to some minds more brilliant than his older brother Henry. Clarence King, whose desire to liberate Cuba was not lessened by his lust for mulatto women. And Jolly Judge William H. Taft of the Sixth Circuit, the most popular man in town. Charles A. Dana, editor of The Sun, and John Hay, now ambassador to the Court of St. James, represented the Roosevelt point of view in New York and London. Many other men of more or less consequence cooperated with these in the effort to make America a world power before the turn of the century. and they looked increasingly to Theodore Roosevelt for inspiration as 1897 wore on. The Assistant Secretary of the Navy worked quietly and unobtrusively for over 7 weeks before making his first public address at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, on 2 June. It turned out to be the first great speech of his career, a fanfare call to arms which echoed all the more resoundingly for the pause that had preceded it. He chose as his theme a maxim by George Washington. "To be prepared for war is the most effectual means to promote peace." This, to Roosevelt's mind, could signify only one thing in 1897, an immediate, rapid buildup of the American Navy. He dismissed the suggestion that such a program would tempt the United States into unnecessary war. On the contrary, it would promote peace by keeping foreign navies out of the Western Hemisphere. Should any power be so foolhardy as to attempt invasion, why, that would mean necessary war, which was a fine and healthy thing. "All the great masterful races have been fighting races. And the minute that a race loses the hard-fighting virtues, then it has lost its proud right to stand as the equal of the best." Roosevelt did not have to remind his listeners that the Japanese, fresh from last year's victory over the Chinese, were in full possession of those virtues, and were even now patrolling Hawaiian waters with an armored cruiser. "Cowardice in a race, as in an individual," he declared, "is the unpardonable sin." During the last 2 years alone, various timid European rulers had ignored the massacre of millions of Armenians by the Turks in order to preserve peace in their own lands. Again, Roosevelt did not have to mention Cuba, where Spain's infamous Governor General Weyler was currently slaughtering the insurrectos to make a point. "Better 1,000 times err on the side of over-readiness to fight than to err on the side of tame submission to injury or cold-blooded indifference to the misery of the oppressed." Intoxicated with his theme, Roosevelt continued, "No triumph of peace is quite so great as the supreme triumphs of war. It may be that at some time in the dim future of the race, the need for war will vanish, but that time is yet ages distant. As yet, no nation can hold its place in the world, or can do any work really worth doing, unless it stands ready to guard its rights with an armed hand." Aware that his audience consisted largely of naval academics devoted to the theory rather than the practice of war, Roosevelt praised teachers, scientists, writers, and artists as vital members of a civilized society, but warned against the dangers of too much doctrinaire thinking in formulating national policy. "There are educated men in whom education merely serves to soften the fiber. Only those who have dared greatly in war or the work which is akin to war deserved the best of their country." By now the assistant secretary was using the word war approximately once a minute. He was to repeat it 62 times before he sat down. Roosevelt cited fact after historical fact to prove that it is too late to prepare for war when the time for peace has passed. He poured scorn on Jefferson for seeking to protect the American coastline with small defensive gunboats instead of building a fleet of aggressive battleships which might have prevented the War of 1812. He pointed out that the nation's present vulnerability, with Britain, Germany, Japan, and Spain engaged in a naval arms race, was more alarming than it had been at the beginning of the century. Then, at least, a man of war could be built in a matter of weeks. Now, naval technology was so complicated that no battleship could be finished inside 2 years. Cruisers took almost as long. Even the light, lethal torpedo boat, which he had already made a special priority item in the department, needed 90 days to put into first-class shape. As for munitions, America's current supply was so meager and so obsolete that if war broke out tomorrow, we should have to build not merely the weapons we need, but the plant with which to make them in any large quantity. Roosevelt chillingly demonstrated that it would be 6 months before the United States could parry any sudden attack, and a further 18 months before she could begin to return it. "Since the change in military conditions in modern times, there has never been an instance in which a war between two nations has lasted more than about 2 years. In most recent wars, the operations of the first 90 days have decided the results of the conflict." It was essential, therefore, that Congress move at once to build more ships and bigger ships, whose business is to fight and not to run. Line personnel must be subjected to the highest standards of recruitment and training, while staff officers must have as perfect weapons ready to their hands as can be found in the civilized world. This new navy would be more to America's international advantage than the most brilliant corps of ambassadors. Diplomacy, Roosevelt insisted, is utterly useless when there is no force behind it. The diplomat is the servant, not the master of the soldier. Moving into his peroration, he anticipated another great war speech by 43 years in a eulogy to the blood and sweat and tears which heroes must sacrifice for the cause of freedom. He begged his audience to remember that there are higher things in this life than the soft and easy enjoyment of material comfort. It is through strife, or the readiness for strife, that a nation must win greatness. We ask for a great navy, partly because we feel that no national life is worth having if the nation is not willing, when the need shall arise, to stake everything on the supreme arbitrament of war, and to pour out its blood, its treasure, and its tears like water, rather than submit to the loss of honor and renown. Roosevelt's speech was printed in full in all major newspapers and caused a nationwide sensation. From Boston to San Francisco, from Chicago to New Orleans, expansionist editors and correspondents praised it and agreed that a new, defiantly original spirit had entered into the conduct of American affairs. "Well done, nobly spoken," exclaimed the Washington Post. "Theodore Roosevelt, you have found your place at last." The Sun called his words manly, patriotic, intelligent, and convincing. The Herald recommended that readers study this lofty speech from its opening sentence to its close, while the New Orleans Daily Picayune said that it undoubtedly voices the sentiments of the great majority of thinking people. Even such anti-expansionist journals as Harper's Weekly found the address very eloquent and forcible, although the commentator Carl Schurz logically demolished Roosevelt's main argument. If too much peace led to softening of the national fiber, Schurz argued, and war led to vigor and love of country, it followed that prevention of war would only be debilitating. Ergo, the building up of a great war fleet will affect that which promotes effeminacy and languishing on patriotism. Schurz should have left his syllogism there, for it was unanswerable, but he went on to argue dreamily that the United States was so protected by foreign balances of power that no nation dare attack it. This made him sound like one of the naive doctrinaires Roosevelt had criticized in his speech, and served only to justify the assistant secretary's warnings. "I suspect that Roosevelt is right," President McKinley sighed to Lemuel Eli Quigg, "and the only difference between him and me is that mine is the greater responsibility." This startling admission by a chief executive personally committed to a policy of non-aggression suggests that Roosevelt had more than mere headlines in mind when he spoke to the Naval War College that June afternoon. His words were obviously intended to create, rather than just influence, national foreign policy. In both timing and targeting, the speech was accurate as a karate chop, for Hawaii and Cuba were the issues of the hour, and the Naval War College was the nerve center of American strategic planning. The isolationists in the cabinet never quite recovered from Roosevelt's blow, and its shock effects were felt in every extremity of the administration. Traditionally, the Naval War College had been founded to give officers advanced instruction in science and history of marine warfare. But during the course of nearly a decade of domination by Alfred Thayer Mahan, it had also become the prime source of war plans for the government. These documents, drawn up by brilliant young Mahanites ambitious to thrust the American Navy into the 20th century, were submitted for consideration by the Office of Naval Intelligence in Washington, whence they went to the Secretary of the Navy for approval or rejection. Under the conservative administration of President Cleveland, the Office of Naval Intelligence had acted as a foil to the Naval War College, toning down its more strident proposals, and Secretary Herbert saw to it that such war plans were pigeonholed before they had any effect on national defense policy. Herbert, indeed, was so suspicious of the War College that he had organized a senior board, consisting mainly of old guard officers, to keep both it and the Office of Naval Intelligence safely under control. With the accession of President McKinley, however, the composition of the board changed radically. A few days after Roosevelt's arrival in the Navy Department, it was ordered to exhume two of the most recent war plans and to produce a new strategy in the light of recent developments in the Pacific and Caribbean. Captain Caspar F. Goodrich, president of the Naval War College, was just beginning to work on this document when Roosevelt chose to deliver his bellicose address to the staff and class of 97. There could not possibly have been a stronger hint as to what kind of thinking the new war plan should contain. Roosevelt had, in fact, already sent Captain Goodrich a special confidential problem for academic deliberation. Japan makes demands on Hawaiian Islands. This country intervenes. What force will be necessary to uphold the intervention, and how should it be employed? Keeping in mind possible complications with another power on the Atlantic coast, Cuba. Such a problem would never exist, he privately informed Captain Mahan, if I had my way. In an undisguised fantasy of himself as commander-in-chief, Roosevelt continued that he would annex those islands tomorrow. If that was impossible, I would establish a protectorate over them. I believe we should build the Nicaraguan Canal at once, and in the meantime, that we should build a dozen new battleships, half of them on the Pacific coast. I would send the Oregon, and if necessary, also the Monterey, to Hawaii, and would hoist our flag over the island, leaving all details for after action. He acknowledged that there were big problems in the West Indies, but until Spain was turned out of Cuba, and if I had my way, he repeated, that would be done tomorrow. The United States would always be plagued by trouble there. We should acquire the Danish islands. I do not fear England. Canada is hostage for her good behavior. In the midst of his flow of dictation, recorded at the Navy Department, Roosevelt seems to have noticed that his stenographer's neck was flushing. I need not say, he hastily went on, that this letter must be strictly private. To no one else excepting Lodge do I speak like this. It would appear, nevertheless, that he expressed himself almost as strongly to Assistant Secretary of State William R. Day, at least on the subject of Hawaii. So, too, did Lodge and other members of the expansionist lobby. Bypassing Day's senile superior, John Sherman, they persuaded President McKinley to approve a treaty of annexation on 16 June 1897. The treaty was forwarded to the Senate, where Lodge triumphantly undertook to secure its ratification, and Roosevelt rejoiced. It is fair to assume that champagne was drunk in the Metropolitan Club that evening. At last, America had joined the other great powers of the world in the race for empire. The next morning, Secretary Long, who was beginning to feel the heat of approaching summer, left town for 2 weeks' vacation, preparatory to taking his main vacation. Roosevelt was relieved to be alone for a while, since the secretary had not been at all pleased with his War College speech, and was already resisting pleas for a buildup of the Navy. Beneath the kindly exterior, he sensed an old man's obstinacy which gave him the most profound concern. It would hardly do to have the pace of naval construction slow just as the expansion movement was accelerating. I feel that you ought to write to him, Roosevelt told Mahan. Not immediately, but sometime not far in the future, explaining to him the vital need for more battleships. Make the plea that this is a measure of peace and not war. Roosevelt's easy recourse to the world's ranking naval authority, now and on many subsequent occasions in his career as assistant secretary, makes it worthwhile to examine their complex relationship, or more accurately, re-examine it, in the light of the enduring belief that the younger man's naval philosophy was inherited from the older. Facts recently uncovered suggest the reverse. In 1881, when the 22-year-old Roosevelt sat writing The Naval War of 1812 in New York's Astor Library, Mahan had been an obscure 40-year-old career officer of no particular accomplishment, literary or otherwise. He did not publish his own first book, A Workmanlike History of Gulf Operations in the Civil War, until 2 years later, by which time Roosevelt's prodigiously detailed volume was required reading on all U.S. Navy vessels, and had exerted at least a peripheral influence on the decision of Congress to build a fleet of modern warships. Mahan, indeed, was still so unlettered in world naval history that in 1884, when offered an instructorship at the new Naval War College, he asked for a year's leave to study for it. Most of 1885 was spent in the Astor Library, reading the same tomes Roosevelt had already devoured. This research was the basis of Mahan's lecture course at the War College, which in turn became The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, 1890. Long before this masterpiece appeared, however, he had familiarized himself with Roosevelt's theories, to the extent of discussing them with him personally. At least one of the other instructors at the War College, Professor J. Russell Soley, was an enthusiastic Rooseveltian. So, too, was the institution's founder, Admiral Stephen B. Luce. Your book must be our textbook, Luce told the young author. Roosevelt's next two histories, Gouverneur Morris and Thomas Hart Benton, were replete with arguments for a strong navy and mercantile marine, while The Winning of the West propounded visions of Anglo-Saxon world conquest as heady as anything Mahan ever wrote. All of these works predated the influence of sea power upon history. The relative academic prestige of Roosevelt and Mahan altered drastically in the latter's favor after sea power came out. As has been seen, Roosevelt enthusiastically welcomed the book, reviewing it, and all Mahan's subsequent volumes, with a generosity that could not fail to endear him to the austere, reclusive scholar. During his early years in Washington, he worked to save Mahan from sea duty, which the captain detested, and to increase his backing in government circles. It is not surprising, therefore, that when the new assistant secretary sought to advance his own ambitions in the spring of 1897, he could call upon Mahan in confidence. The fact that their naval philosophies were identical at this point only increased the willingness of one man to help the other. Finding himself in full, if temporary, control of the Navy Department, Roosevelt worked energetically but cautiously, not wanting to jeopardize his chances of being acting secretary through most of the summer. He signed with pleasure a letter of permission for general maneuvers by the North Atlantic Squadron in August or September, and told its commanding officer that he would particularly like to be aboard for a day or two during gun practice. He continued to dig up Secretary Herbert's suppressed reports, on the grounds that those most deeply buried might yield the most interesting information, ordered an investigation of the management of the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and proposed that some of the great names in American naval history be revived on future warships. He suggested the installation of rapid-fire weaponry throughout the fleet. Horrified when an elderly, bureaucratic admiral boasted about being able to account for every single bottle of red and black ink supplied to ships around the world, Roosevelt initiated a massive campaign to reduce the department's paperwork. Soothingly, he wrote to Long, "There isn't the slightest necessity of your returning." Undismayed by strong Japanese protest regarding the Hawaii Treaty, Roosevelt set his expansionist lobby to work on the subject of Cuba, this hideous welter of misery on our doorsteps. On 18 June, he invited several key senators to dine at the Metropolitan Club with an envoy recently returned from the island. Elsewhere on the propaganda front, he played off two publishers, Harper's and G.P. Putnam's Sons, in competition for a volume of politico-social essays covering the whole of his career as a speaker and man of letters. Articles on the manly virtues and true Americanism were prominent among them, along with his most ambitious reviews, National Life and Character, Social Evolution, and The Law of Civilization and Decay. For good measure, he added his recent address to the Naval War College. "I am rather pleased with them myself," he told Putnam's, the successful bidder. Less robust tastes were repelled by a cumulative impression of jingoism, militarism, and self-righteousness when the essays came out under the title American Ideals. "If there is one thing more than another for which I admire you, Theodore," said Thomas B. Reed, "it is your original discovery of the Ten Commandments." Henry James, reviewing the volume for a British periodical, expressed mock alarm. "Mr. Theodore Roosevelt appears to propose to tighten the screws of the national consciousness as they have never been tightened before. It is purely as an American," he constantly reminds us, "that each of us must live and breathe. Breathing, indeed, is a trifle. It is purely as Americans that we must think, and all that is wanting to the author's demonstration is that he shall give us a receipt for the process." James granted that Roosevelt had a happy touch when he eschewed questions of doctrine for accounts of his own political experiences. "These pages give an impression of high competence, but his value is impaired for intelligible precept by the puerility of his simplifications." Such criticism, of course, was only to be expected from white-livered expatriates, and Roosevelt took no notice of James's remarks, if he even bothered to read them. From now on, he would pour out a swelling flood of patriotic speeches and articles, aided by such other expansionists as Mahan, Brooks Adams, and Albert Shaw, until the last remaining dikes of isolationism burst under the pressure. The Navy Department's new war plan was ready on 30 June. 3 days before Secretary Long returned from vacation. Roosevelt had no authority to approve it, but it was a document that gladdened his eyes nevertheless. All the more aggressive features of the earlier plans had been restored, and the weaker ones eliminated. In addition, there were some new, flagrantly expansionist proposals which proved prophetic to a degree. In brief, the plan postulated a war with Spain for the liberation of Cuba. Hostilities would take place mainly in the Caribbean, but the U.S. Navy would also attack the Philippines and even the Mediterranean shores of Europe, if necessary. The Caribbean strategy called for a naval blockade of Cuba, combined with invasion by a small army force. No permanent occupation of Cuba was suggested, but the plan proceeded to discuss the Philippines in tones hardly calculated to reassure Republican conservatives. "We could probably have a controlling voice as to what should become of the islands when a final settlement with Filipino rebels was made." Roosevelt's Metropolitan Club's circle widened in the early days of summer to include two new associates, Captain Leonard Wood, the president's assistant attending surgeon, and Commodore George Dewey, president of the Board of Inspection and Survey. He met the former at a dinner party early in June. When he met the latter is not known, but the name Dewey appears in his correspondence for the first time on 28 June. Both men were to play major roles in his life, and he in theirs. Wood was a doctor by profession and a soldier by choice. He excelled in both capacities. His looks were noble, his physical presence splendid as a Viking's. Tall, fair, lithe, and powerfully muscled, he walked with the slightly pigeon-toed stride of a born athlete and was forever compulsively kicking a football around an empty lot, the leather thudding nearly flat as he drove it against the wall. Roosevelt, who as civil service commissioner had won fame as the most strenuous pedestrian in Washington, was impressed to discover that this newcomer could outpace and outclimb him with no signs of fatigue. "He walked me off my legs," the assistant secretary told Lodge, with some surprise. Ever the boy, he hero-worshipped Wood, although the doctor was 2 years his junior, as a fighter of Apaches and a vanquisher of Geronimo. Wood's personality was clear, forceful, honest, and unassuming. Best of all, he was an ardent expansionist and could not stop talking about Cuba as a wound on the national conscience. Roosevelt decided that this quiet, charming man with excellent military connections, Wood was married to the niece of U.S. Army Commanding General Nelson A. Miles, must needs be cultivated. Little old Commodore Dewey was a total contrast. Nut brown, wiry, and vain, he was in his 60th year when Roosevelt befriended him, but the size of his personal ambition was in inverse proportion to his age and height. Over 3 decades of undistinguished peacetime service had not quenched his lust for battle, kindled as a lieutenant under Farragut in the Civil War. Now, with retirement only 3 years off, Dewey was forced to accept the fact that glory might never be his. Yet the Commodore still bore himself with fierce pride, immaculate in tailored uniform and polished, high-instepped boots. He was without doubt the smartest dresser in the Navy. "It was said of him," wrote one reporter, "that the creases of his trousers were as well-defined as his views on naval warfare." With his beaky nose and restless, caged strut, Dewey looked like a resplendent killer falcon, ready to bite through wire, if necessary, to get at a likely prey. The Commodore had attracted Roosevelt's admiring attention as long ago as the Chilean crisis of 1891, when he voluntarily bought coal for his ship instead of waiting for official battle orders. Any officer whose instinct was to stoke up before a crisis, at his own expense, could be trusted in wartime. Like Wood, Dewey was a dedicated expansionist, lunching and dining daily at the Metropolitan Club. Like Wood, he was a man of action rather than thought. Roosevelt began to muse ways of giving him command of the Asiatic Squadron when Rear Admiral Fred V. McNair retired later in the year. In the meantime, their friendship ripened. Often, on a sunny afternoon after work, they could be seen riding in Rock Creek Park together. At the beginning of July, it was the Assistant Secretary's turn to take a brief vacation. He headed north for a reunion with Edith, pregnant now with his 6th child. Distracted as he was with naval affairs and plans for the coming war, whose certainty he never questioned, Roosevelt allowed himself 10 days of quiet domesticity at Oyster Bay. "The white marble city on the Potomac was all very well," he told Bammy, "but permanently, nothing could be lovelier than Sagamore." And nothing could be more satisfying than to see his own progeny growing sturdy and sunburned in his own fields. Roosevelt confessed to Cecil Spring Rice that the diminishing rate of increase in America's population worried him in contrast to the fecundity of the Slav. Looking around Sagamore Hill, he gave thanks that his own family, at least, had shown valor in the warfare of the cradle. With various cousins who had come to stay, there were 16 small Roosevelts in his house. Edith, watching him crawling through tunnels in the hay barn in pursuit of squealing boys and girls, was inclined to put the number one higher. The eldest cousin was a good-looking lad of 15 from Groton, named Franklin. He had been invited to Oyster Bay earlier in the year after a lecture by Roosevelt to his schoolmates on life as a police commissioner of New York City. The talk, which kept the boys in stitches of laughter, impressed young Franklin as splendid. From this summer on, he deliberately modeled his career on that of Cousin Theodore, whom he would always describe as the greatest man he ever knew. On 11 July, Roosevelt enjoyed one of the privileges of his new job by cruising from Oyster Bay to Newport in a torpedo boat. The swiftness and responsiveness of the little vessel delighted him. "Like riding a high-mettled horse," he wrote. He did not, like some critics, find its thin-shelled vulnerability a tactical disadvantage. "With these torpedo boats, frailty is part of the very essence of their being." Such comments suggest that Roosevelt was not altogether a landlubber, although in general he did prefer the abstract flow of arrows on paper to the heaving, splashing realities of naval movement. After witnessing some trials at Newport, he set off for a tour of the Great Lakes Naval Militia Stations in Mackinac, Detroit, Chicago, and Sandusky. His speech to the latter establishment, on 23 July, contained a violent reply to Japan's protest against the annexation of Hawaii. "The United States," Roosevelt thundered, "is not in a position which requires her to ask Japan, or any other foreign power, what territory it shall or shall not acquire." The Tribune called his outburst a distinct impropriety and suggested that he leave to the Department of State the declaration of the foreign policy of this government. John D. Long, who was a man of delicate nervous constitution, had barely recovered from his subordinate's previous speech to the Naval War College before the news from Sandusky came in. "The headlines nearly threw the secretary into a fit," Roosevelt told Lodge, "and he gave me as heavy a wigging as his invariable courtesy and kindness would permit." Abject apologies smoothed the incident over, but Long must have had some scruples about putting Roosevelt in charge of the department through Labor Day as planned. However, the need to resume his vacation was paramount, and on 2 August, Roosevelt found himself installed as the hot weather secretary. He now entered upon one of those periods of near incredible industry which always characterized his assumption of new responsibility, whether it be the management of a ranch, the researching of a book, or as in this case, the administration of the most difficult department in the United States government. Quite apart from its complex structure, with 7 bureaus issuing streams of documents on such subjects as naval law, steam engineering, diplomacy, finance, strategy, education, science, astronomy, and hydrography, there was the huge extra dimension of the Navy itself, a proud hierarchical institution traditionally resistant to change and contemptuous of civilian authority. The multiple task of reconciling the various bureaus with one another and the department with the fleet, while simultaneously dealing with Congress, the White House, the press, and countless industrial contractors, was enough to frustrate anybody but a Roosevelt. "I perfectly revel in this work," he exulted to Long. For the first time in his life, he had real power in full measure. As acting secretary, he was answerable only to his chief and President McKinley, both of whom were away from town for at least 6 weeks. Praying that the latter would come back a few days before the former, since he wished to have a private talk with him, Roosevelt abandoned himself to the drug of hyperactivity. "I am having immense fun running the Navy," he told Bellamy Storer on 19 August. His industry during that first month confirms Henry Adams's remark, "Theodore Roosevelt was pure act." In just 22 days of official duty, he managed to write a report of his tour of the naval militia, inspect a fleet of first and second-class battleships off Sandy Hook, expedite a stalled order for diagonal armor supplies, devise a public relations plan for press coverage of the forthcoming North Atlantic Squadron exercises, set up a board to investigate ways of relieving the chronic dry dock shortage, introduce a new post-tradership system, weigh and pronounce verdict upon the Brooklyn Navy Yard probe, surreptitiously backdate a Bureau of Navigation employment form in order to favor a protege of Senator Cushman Davis, extend his anti-red tape reforms to cover battleships and cruisers, eliminate the department's backlog of unfilled appointments, draw up an elaborate cruising schedule for the new torpedo boat flotilla, settle a row between the bureaus of ordnance and construction, review the relative work programs in various Navy yards, draft a naval personnel reform bill, and fire all Navy Department employees who rated a sub-70 mark in the semi-annual fitness reports, all the while making regular reports to the vacationing secretary, in tones calculated both to soothe and flatter. "I shan't send you anything unless it is really important," Roosevelt wrote. "You must be tired, and you ought to have an entire rest." He begged Long not to answer his letters, "for I don't want you bothered at all." As for coming back after Labor Day, there was not the slightest earthly reason to return before the end of September. Long, happily pottering about his garden, was more than content to remain away. Ensconced as he was in rural Massachusetts, he probably did not see a lengthy analysis in the New York Sun of 23 August of European reaction to the expansionist movement in the United States. One paragraph read, "The liveliest spot in Washington at present is the Navy Department. The decks are cleared for action. Acting Secretary Roosevelt, in the absence of Governor Long, has the whole Navy bordering on a war footing. It remains only to sand down the decks and pipe to quarters for action." "Yes, indeed," Roosevelt was writing. "I wish I could be with you for just a little while and see the lovely hill farm to which your grandfather came over 90 years ago. Now, stay there just exactly as long as you want to." In his spare hours, as he put it, Roosevelt amused himself by writing and editing another volume of Boone and Crockett Club Big Game Lore, dictating one of his enormous prophetic letters to Cecil Spring Rice. "If Russia chooses to develop purely on her own line and resist the growth of liberalism, she will sometime experience a red terror that will make the French Revolution pale," and assembling a series of quotations by various presidents on the subject of an aggressive navy. As he read his anthology through, it struck him as a powerful piece of propaganda, and he determined to publish it after first mailing the text to Long for approval. The secretary saw no harm in it, providing that Roosevelt inserted the words, "in my opinion," somewhere in the introduction, to show that it was not an official statement of policy by the Navy Department. An advance copy was sent to President McKinley on 30 August, and in early September the Government Printing Office issued it under the title, "The Naval Policy of America as Outlined in Messages of the Presidents of the United States from the Beginning to the Present Day." It drew admiring comment in most newspapers, timely being the adjective most frequently used. Besides being a miniature history of the U.S. Navy, the pamphlet showed a striking similarity of thought between Presidents Washington, Jackson, Lincoln, and Grant on the one hand, and Assistant Secretary of the Navy Roosevelt on the other. No quotations by Thomas Jefferson were deemed worthy of inclusion. About this time, Roosevelt added yet another influential voice to his expansionist propaganda machine. William Allen White was not yet 30. But he was proprietor and editor of a powerful Midwestern newspaper, the Emporia Gazette, and had won a national following in 1896 with a diatribe against the populists, "What's the Matter with Kansas?" Printed first as an editorial in his own paper, then reprinted and distributed in millions of copies by Mark Hanna, the piece had been the single most effective broadsheet of McKinley's campaign. Roosevelt had read the famous editorial with interest. Here was the natural Republican antidote to William Jennings Bryan, and a much better metaphorist to boot. If he could take White in hand and teach him the gospel of expansionism, he would enlarge his own sphere of influence by thousands of readers and thousands of square miles. Roosevelt did not care who propounded Rooseveltian views, even if they won glory by doing so. What mattered was that the message got through. When he heard that White was in Washington on a patronage mission, he asked for him to be sent down to the Navy Department. Blonde, red-faced, and pudgy, White looked the typical corn-fed hick journalist, yet his intelligence was acute, and his language rich and rolling as the Midwest itself. Their meeting was casual, little more than a handshake and an agreement to have lunch next day. But Roosevelt was so radiant with newfound power that White was unable to sit down for excitement afterward. "I was afire with the splendor of the personality that I had met." The little Kansan was still stepping on air the following afternoon when Roosevelt escorted him to the Metropolitan Club and signaled for the menu. Both men were compulsive eaters and compulsive talkers, and for the next hour they awarded each other equal time, greed alternating with rhetoric. In old age, White fondly recalled double mutton chops, seas of speculation, excursions of delight into books and men and manners, poetry and philosophy. Roosevelt spoke with shocking frankness about the leaders of the government,